agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Trey Orndorff, a political scientist at Oklahoma Christian University, and I'm joined by Ken Katkin, a professor at law at Chase Law School. Are you ready for some keen insights this week, Ken?
Oh, yeah.
I threw you for earlier, but I did that. Anyway, but before we get started and we get deep dive into Ken's insights into this week's news, I'd like to mention our first sponsor, the Democracy Group. Our first sponsor today is the Democracy Group. The Democracy Group is a network of podcasts united around the goal of helping listeners understand what's broken in our democracy and how people are working together to fix it. In their podcasts, you'll hear from scholars, policy experts, journalists, organizers, and everyday people who are exercising their rights and responsibilities as democratic citizens. All of the podcasts in the Democracy Group go beyond the partisan horse race to examine larger scale issues of politics, government, and civil society. The Democracy Group includes a number of shows whose hosts you've heard right here on The Politics Guys in the past, such as Future Hindsight, Democracy Works, and The Science of Politics. Other great podcasts in the network include Our Democracy Matters, How Do We Fix It?, In the Arena, Out of Order, and Swamp Stories. For more information about the Democracy Group, including the latest episodes from member shows and deep dive playlists on topics like immigration, gerrymandering, and money in politics, visit their website at democracygroup.org. You'll find the URL in today's show notes. Now, coming back to our show, Ken, and the politics guys, one of the things this week that comes up is that Bernie Sanders brings in 24 more delegates, beating out Joe Biden with 9 and Buttigieg with 3. And again, he did it with less than a majority of the vote. He only pulls in 46.8% of the vote in Nevada. But he is beginning to be labeled the front runner. And that always kind of worries me a little bit, because as we were mentioning, even in the ad, that really does play into the horse race narrative of primaries. Now, instead of kind of getting into that horse race, and I think even in our bonus shows, we've already made predictions about this. I thought we might talk a little bit about what we see as being the factors that go into determining presidential elections. And I think we might even do that in light of Sanders as being the nominee, not so much for a horse race, but just for the comparison of trying to understand, well, when and why do incumbents win and lose? Because, you know, right now, as you well know, a lot of ink is being spilled over Sanders, the nominee, especially in light of some of his comments this week about Cuba, about is he electable? So what does it mean for anyone to be electable? What does it mean for Sanders to be electable? And what does it look like in a general election between Sanders and Trump? And so, Ken, I'm going to throw that over to you to start with.
Yeah, well, in the general election, of course, the Electoral College is really everything. So when we ask about what does it mean for Sanders to be electable, I think we're really asking what does it mean for Sanders to be electable in Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, maybe Florida, maybe Arizona, possibly Ohio. You know, I think those are the sort of the key places. I think in 44 states, it's not going to matter who the nominee is. You know, there's 44 states where we could pretty much say either President Trump's going to win or the Democrat's going to win without regard to who the Democrat is. So the Castro stuff that you pointed out, of course, that probably does have resonance in one. It has a lot of resonance in one of those states I just mentioned, right?
Florida. Yeah.
And I don't think it's helpful in Florida. I think it would probably be easier for somebody like a Joe Biden to get elected in Florida. I think Biden could win Florida. Otherwise, I think the Democrats have a little bit of an uphill battle in Florida, and Sanders probably most of all. Although maybe the Cuba issue is not as resonant with the third generation Cuban Americans as it was with the first and second generation Cuban Americans. So who knows? But I do think that's what we really have to be thinking about, is what kind of individual factors that affect voters uniquely in the five or six closest states would relate to electability.
I agree. And I think one of the things that a lot of, you know, I mentioned the ink being spilled, is that we're always taking a look at kind of nationalized polls. And really, that's a horrible metric to make a decision on how individuals are going to win. The way that I really look at the map, I think that probably the four states that are leaning the most are going to be Wisconsin, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. As a matter of fact, I think that if you look, if you kind of put in leaning Republican and leaning Democrat when you're looking at the numbers for more Sanders specifically, I think Florida is pretty much safe Trump territory against the Sanders, and I don't think it would be against a different potential challenger. So what do you think? Well, A, what do you think about that? Because it sounds like you maybe thought a little bit differently. And what especially about Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, which I think were going to be really key kind of toss-up states?
Yeah. No, I think I said the same thing as you about Florida. I think Sanders has a much harder route to Florida than most of the other Dems. Yeah. Yeah. I think I said the same thing you said. I mean, Wisconsin and I would put Michigan in the group that you had with Wisconsin. In fact, I think Michigan's probably more available to the Democrats than Ohio is.
I think Michigan's probably leaning, you know, I think their 16 is leaning Democratic, to be honest.
Yeah. So and Ohio is probably the toughest of those four for a Democrat right now. But I think Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, you know, they've all elected Democratic governors. They all have sitting Democratic governors. The Democrats did pretty well in the midterms in 28 in all those states, 2018. One of the weird demographic mysteries about those particular states, I think, is which Democrat can appeal to the, say, over 45 white non-college educated voters who pretty much were part of the Democratic base until Trump took them away. Excuse me, I'm coughing. Until Trump took them away, you know, that can any of these Democrats get them back? And, you know, people like Michael Moore would say that Sanders is the one who can get them back. I'm not sure that the polling completely reflects that view. So I don't know.
Well, and I'm glad you kind of leave it there, because one of the things that as you take a look at it is that, and I know that there are many on the left who are going to take issue with this one. But when you take a look at the number of individuals in the generalized population who are willing to vote for somebody, and again, I understand that there's nuance here, but for someone who is actively labeling themselves as a Democratic socialist, right? Adding that word socialist makes him poll about the same. And again, I'm not suggesting this is a good or a bad thing, just the way it is, but somebody who is actively a Muslim. And now, should that be that way? That's a different question. But I just don't understand where that voter you're talking about, Ken, I don't think that they're going to be appealed enough to split from Trump or to turn out, because I think one of the things that Democrats need, and Sanders specifically needs, is he has to have a lot of turnout at the younger level. He's going to need young people who historically don't turn up to turn out in levels that are probably a little bit north of what Obama had them showing up with. What do you think about that kind of analysis?
Well, yeah, I agree with the big point, but maybe I'll nitpick a little bit of the smaller points there. I don't think the label socialist is going to hurt him that much. I think the evidence of that is how well he's doing in the primaries and in the polls. I mean, he's been calling himself that a long time. And he's, you know, I mean, of course, he's only got about 30% of the Democratic vote, but that's more than anyone else has got. So I don't know that hurts him so much.
And that's come to the fore yet. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, this is going to be, I mean, if I was running Trump's campaign, I'm going to have every ad in the world make sure that it's, you know, Bernie Sanders, Democratic socialist. But continue. I didn't mean to interrupt you, Ken.
I get it. No, I mean, I think, you know, Republicans will get energized by that. But, you know, I don't know that capitalism in this country has the good name that it used to have. And I think there's some, you know, more voters out there who are, you know, maybe thinking that some kind of dramatic change in our economic system is needed. And to the extent that Sanders can portray what he calls democratic socialism as really being about or social democracy, I should say, as really being about some redistribution away from the 1%, I don't think that hurts him. I mean, I think if you look at someone like Elizabeth Warren, who has similar policies but never uses the word socialist, Sanders is doing a lot better than Elizabeth Warren.
I don't disagree on that front. But I mean, again, you know, 2019, asking voters, you know, quote, are they going to feel comfortable voting for a socialist? That, I mean, not that they would, but they'd feel comfortable with it. You only get 39% polling in that direction. And it seems to me that you need to have that number well north of 50 if you're hoping, especially as you were pointing out in a minute ago, and we were agreeing about that, you need to pull in maybe that more traditional voter in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, he's going to need to address it. If he gets into the general election, he is going to need to address it. I agree with you there. I don't think it's insurmountable. I would sort of put it in the by way of comparison, like when people were concerned about Barack Obama having been a parishioner in Reverend Jeremiah Wright's church, and people thought for a while that would be politically poisonous and disqualifying. You know, he had to make a speech about it, and he made a speech about it. And, you know, I'm sure his speech didn't pacify Republicans who didn't like him, but it obviously did pacify enough Democrats and independents that he was able to put that issue behind him and get elected and get elected again. And I think Sanders would have to do something like that. He'd have to give a speech where he explains what he meant when he talked about social democracy, where he repudiates certain kinds of socialism that the Americans are never going to go for, and where he puts himself squarely in the mainstream of popular opinion on issues like inequality. I think he would have to do that. There's work to do. I just don't think it's impossible to do it.
Now, that's I wouldn't have made that analogy, because it seems like for Obama, he had more of a message, just a purely messaging issue. And maybe this is where we're disagreeing a little bit, but it seems to me that Sanders, I think he's being honest, but I think his honest position probably puts him in a position that is outside. In other words, I think he's going to need more than a speech. I think he'd have to be willing to meaningfully moderate in that speech so as to drive up the number of potential voters in a way that I don't think with Obama and kind of, you know, the church incident would be quite analogous. I get what you're getting at there. Do you see what I'm saying? I mean,
Yeah. But so let me ask you then. So what particular issue would you say that Sanders's current views are so far out of the mainstream? On what issue would that be where he'd seriously have to change his views to find mainstream acceptance rather than just seriously explaining his position?
I think the one that he's going to have to give up on is, well, and this is something that I think later that we'll tackle in the extended bonus show. But for here, I think he's going to have to be willing to give on the idea of the number of items that he wants to be in the hands of the federal government. In other words, he's going to have to deal with the budgetary issue, and he's going to have to be willing to say, well, I can't win all of those. And because I think if he wants all of them, that's what then leads to the easy and probably rightfully, democratic socialist label being difficult to move forward. I don't think the average American wants government involved in everything, even if they might, in particular issues, like I said, for healthcare, have frustration. I think that a Medicare for all with the price tag that it's going to be is one that's an easy slam against him. And that's the reason that Obama had to back off.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think he will have to back off on Medicare for all if he becomes the candidate. But I think it's only a small kind of rhetorical backing off, because I think what he has to say is that there's not enough support in the Congress for it. And he's going to try to make the incremental improvements to extend health care and control costs that are politically possible. He's not going to pursue things that are impossible, but that his long-term goal would remain Medicare for all. And I think something like that in a general election campaign could work, because it really isn't going to be that different of a position ultimately than where any of the other Democratic candidates are. And it's true that that's the only possible way to work through Congress on these issues. So I don't think he ends up looking insincere if he retreats to that position.
Well, and I think on that front, he also has to, this past week, Forbes had an op-ed, if only Bernie were an economist. And in this one, it sounds like it's going to be attacking Sanders. But in fact, it was very sympathetic, arguing that Sanders' proposals aren't as economically crazy as they might seem to the average voter. And one of them is, look, you know, you're going to, you know, taxes are going to go up on lower income folks to make these things pay way high on the upper scale. But it's going to have to trickle down to make this work. But it doesn't matter which pocket you're paying it out of, right? In other words, whether you're paying, you know, health insurance costs out of your left pocket, i.e. privately, you're paying out your right pocket to taxes. But I actually fundamentally disagree with the author on that front. I think in most cases, people do care what pot. I mean, you know, maybe as a purely economic position, but that ignores the politics of it, and it ignores that there are things for which people don't. They would rather pay for it privately at maybe a 1% more expense overall, or a 2% or a 3% expense more overall than they would out of their pocket to the federal government, so as that it wouldn't be there. So I think that's more than a little bit of a pushback. I think that's a sense of where he's going to have to recognize, look, I don't think that the kind of taxing policy that he wants is going to be electable.
Yeah, I mean, I partly agree with that, but I would say a big part of what you just said, I think, is more about what distinguishes Democrats from Republicans than about what distinguishes Sanders from the other Democrats. Oh, right. Okay. So it's certainly true that Sanders goes a little farther in those directions than other Democratic candidates would go. Although I think Sanders may be closer to where a lot of the Democratic electorate is. And I think a lot of the Democrat electorate, if they think of something like, public K through 12 schools, mm-hmm. you know, I know a lot of Republicans have problems with that, but I think a lot of Democrats would say, well, even though my property taxes could probably be damn near zero if there were no public schools, I still think that there should be public schools, that there should be free public schooling for everybody. And I think that's kind of that's a little bit of a metaphor for how I think a lot of the Democratic voters are thinking. And I understand that a lot of Republican voters don't think that way, but I think that Sanders is sort of building on something that already does have some appeal to the mind frame of the Democratic electorate.
I'm even kind of thinking back to the debate between Sanders and Clinton, where Clinton kind of rails him and gets a significant amount of praise. Says, look, capitalism has worked. We don't want to get rid of this. We just need to have kind of that Rawlsian safety net. And so what I hear you saying essentially is that you think that there are more Democratic electorates who would agree with Sanders on that than they would with Clinton on that.
No, that's one of the ones I think is more of a messaging thing, because okay. Sanders doesn't want to get rid of he doesn't want to get rid of capitalism. And I think he would have to explain that more clearly, right? That I don't think any of his actual agenda or any of his actual policy proposals in any way get rid of capitalism. It's not really, he's not really a socialist, right? He's just talking about having a higher taxes and having a much stronger social safety net that in fact provides certain things for everybody, not just for poor people. But that's all, I mean, all the money from all that still comes from taxes, and all the taxes still come from the fact that we have capitalism and we have businesses making money and people making money. So there's nothing about his agenda that involves having the government take over the means of industrial production or you know, almost any sector of the economy.
Well, that's true. I mean, I almost agreed with you.
Yeah.
I agree in the sense that he's not advocating for control of the commanding heights of the economy, right, in that kind of ideal socialist vision. But, I mean, he's clearly a democratic socialist in the Fabian tradition. And I think the answer that makes him qualitatively different than, say, from the Clinton or from the Sanders is the fact that there are a number of industries in which he doesn't want there to be market forces at play. And I think that is a qualitative shift. And you're right, that doesn't end capitalism in the United States. But it's certainly a degree of what I think we could all qualitatively assert is a kind of socialism, albeit not the kind that is often used as the boogeyman or is used in that scapegoat. But I just mean as an intellectual enterprise, that would be socialism.
Well, he wants the government to take over the healthcare sector of the economy, and that is about 17% of the economy. He wants the government, I think, substantially to take over the education sector, although really the government already substantially has the education sector. So that's just a little bit of incremental change there. But I don't think there's other big sectors. And if you look at almost any Western European country, the government has taken over those sectors already. And we don't typically think of countries like the United Kingdom as socialist countries. And I don't think that Sanders's program gets us any more socialist than that.
Well, so I hear you on that front, although I mean, you do have the Labour Party that makes those moves a number of years ago in the United Kingdom, you know, pushing it in that direction for having it. So, I mean, maybe we have a bit of a semantic difference on what we mean there. But, you know, at the end of the day, so as we kind of finish this spot, you don't seem to think that that is as big of an electoral liability as I do. I think you could, it kind of sounds like you think, well, he can explain that away. And that sounds like it's a little bit far too complex to actually explain away in a way that's going to resonate with enough voters to make a meaningful difference come the election time. What would you say to that argument kind of in close?
Yeah. Well, so on your big point, I agree. I think he has a little bit harder of a path to defeating Trump than the more centrist Democrats do. I definitely do agree with that point. And I think your reasoning is correct about why. But I'm just not sure the magnitude of what we're talking about. I think Biden would have an easier time beating Trump than Sanders would, but I don't think it's impossible for Sanders to beat Trump either. I think all of these things would depend on how well he could quiet the fears of voters. And remember, there's a lot of very motivated anti-Trump voters out there. So that gives him a lot of wind at his back. He has to just not terrify them.
Yes.
You know, in order to keep their votes, I think. Yeah. Yeah. And it's not that they have to really love him. And in fact, you know, that was part of Trump's own formula for victory, right? There was a lot of motivated anti-Hillary Clinton voters out there. And many of them had qualms about Trump, and they still voted for Trump. So I think, you know, in that sense, Sanders could expect some of the same, that, you know, many people who have qualms about him, I think he would probably still vote for him because the alternative is Trump. And so that kind of binary choice has a big impact. But I, of course, can't disagree with you that it makes the Democrats' task of winning this election a little bit harder if it's Sanders than if it's one of the more mainstream candidates.
Well, Ken, before we move on to our next story, I'd like to thank our second sponsor for today, Empower. If you'd like to save more in 2020, the Empower app can help make that a reality. With Empower, saving and managing your money couldn't be easier. Their Set It and Forget It autosave function lets you put in weekly savings targets, and then every day Empower studies your income and spending, automatically moves the right amount of money into your savings account where you're less likely to spend it. In addition to that, Empower can actually negotiate your phone and cable bills for you. They've got actual human being coaches you can text for individualized recommendation and high interest FDIC insured checking with absolutely no minimums. If you want to save big this year, download Empower, that's Empower, in the App Store or Play Store. I did it, Mike has done it, and over 650,000 other people have too. And Politics Guys listeners, you get $5 when you use offer code POLITICSGUYS and reach your savings goals. Again, Politics Guys listeners, you get $5 when you use offer code Politics Guys and reach your savings goals. Visit empower.me/politicsguys for more details. So Ken, I want to move on to another interesting case this week. And we were really this week trying to look at a few areas not getting as much coverage, I think in large part due to the ongoing primary fight. And one of this is a lawsuit that is headed to the United States Supreme Court over the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. So to give listeners a little bit of context, in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, Congress, as part of the Dodd-Frank Act, created the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in 2010. And the goal, as they outline, is designed to ensure that banks and financial institutions treat customers fairly. Now, the issue at hand, this as it's coming up this week, and it's one that we actually tackled in my presidency and Congress class here at Oklahoma Christian, is over Article 2 of the Constitution, and specifically whether or not that power, there's a power of removal, or what is called presidential supremacy over the executive branch. Kind of a weird bit of history, it's worth noting. Article 2, it does, and then also Article 1, outlines what happens when you're going to put in a new cabinet officer or another appointed position, right? So the president nominates, and then the Senate has the power of advice and consent. In other words, it has the power to confirm. Now, early on, what was thought was that this meant that the same process would happen for undoing it. As a matter of fact, in Federalist Paper number 77, Hamilton argues that removal can't happen unilaterally. He thought that would be too much power for the presidency. And so, as he put it, quote, the consent of the body, that is the Senate, would be necessary to displace as well as appoint, end quote. In other words, the Senate is part of the removal process. Now, weirdly, though, one of the Federalist Papers authors, Madison, he would argue once he actually gets into the House that the president ought to have the unilateral power to remove any official for any reason. And he does actually in May 1789, if anybody cares to look it up. So what does this have to do with the case? Well, the big deal here is that the CFPB is an executive branch agency created by Congress, and it's led by law by a director who is appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate, that process we were just talking about, for a five-year term. Now, here's where things get interesting. Once confirmed, the law states that the president can't remove the director save for, quote, inefficiency, negligent of duty, or malfeasance in office, end quote. In other words, it's not at will, which has been this now new longstanding practice. So it all comes into this case because the CFPB initiated an investigation into California law firm, Celia Law, and this law firm provides debt relief services. And Celia Law had potentially violated some telemarketing sales rules. CFPB demands some documents, but the law firm declines to provide those documents. So the CFPB sues to get the documents. Now, why don't they give her the documents? Their argument is this. The structure of the agency is unconstitutional because it creates a director who can't be removed at will by the president, only as the law states for these very specific cases. And therefore, it's not going to comply because the position that's giving the authorization for it is unconstitutional. So, Ken, this is your, I know this is kind of your area as a law professor. I happen to know, I know that we're going to be talking about Humphrey's executor versus the United States, because that's kind of the holding case with the FTC. This is a really interesting one for me because I'm always fascinated in presidential power. So, tell us a little bit about this case. The lower courts have upheld that the this Humphrey doctrine applies. What do you think? And why is the Supreme Court taking it on? And what do you think they're going to rule? Talk to us a little bit.
Yeah, well, actually, the I'll tell you about the Humphrey's executor case if you want to know about it. But I don't agree that it's highly relevant to this case. In fact, I think it was already overruled in a case called Morrison versus Olson. So I wouldn't consider Humphrey's executor to be super important. I'll get into all that as I explain it.
Even though the appellate court cited it?
Yeah, well, it was a conservative appellate court also, and a lot of conservative jurisprudence doesn't accept the legitimacy of Morrison versus Olson, which Justice Scalia dissented from. But Morrison versus Olson was a case that was decided by a vote of 7-1 in the 1980s, and it's about the independent counsel statute, right? So the question was, in the post-Watergate era, Congress enacted a statute called the Ethics in Government Act, which provided a mechanism for independent counsels to be appointed by courts to investigate wrongdoing by the White House or by high executive officials. And of course, the most famous of these independent counsels that was appointed under that statute was Ken Starr, who was able to do a sort of full-throated investigation of President Clinton for many different allegations. And President Clinton was not able to remove him because the Ethics in Government Act took that power away from the president. The court held 7-1 that it's perfectly okay for Congress to put a good cause safeguard into removal of an executive officer. So the CFPB statute, which is being challenged in the Seal of Law case, it's identical to the statute that the Supreme Court upheld 7-1 in Morrison versus Olson. I should add, it's also identical to the statute that gives the FBI director a 10-year term of office in which he can only be removed for good cause. And if the CFPB statute is unconstitutional, the FBI statute is unconstitutional. And if the CFPB itself is unconstitutional because of that statute, then the FBI itself is also unconstitutional because of that statute. So I really see this whole case as being just about the Supreme Court's contempt for the CFPB. They're going to trump up some very phony excuse to hold that the CFPB is unconstitutional. The nominal reasoning, which is going to relate to the restrictions on removability of the director of the CFPB, it's nonsense. But I do expect that holding to happen. I expect them to side with Seal of Law and strike down the statute on totally illegitimate grounds.
Now, I noticed that on the government side, they actually are arguing for the Supreme Court to rule much more narrowly, in effect, to bypass the question that you just outlined and argue that the structure is immaterial to the request for documents, and therefore to just rule on the documents and not to rule on the rest of it. But it seems to be what you're saying is you don't think that they're going to take that more narrow ruling. You think they're taking it up to make it more broad.
Yeah, I mean, if they take a case like this that has no legal merit at all, and I think this case has no legal merit at all, and there's no reason for them to take it, then the reason they're taking it is to change the law, right? And so, you know, under existing law, I think the idea that a restriction on removability could mean that the whole agency can't exist just seems fanciful. You know, if there was ever a legitimate vehicle for litigating that, it would be if the president actually tried to fire a director. You know, when the president fired James Comey from the FBI, James Comey acquiesced. He didn't sue to get his job back. But if he would have sued to get his job back, the court could have decided in that case whether the president had the right to fire him or not. But no matter which way it decided that case, that wouldn't mean that the FBI is unconstitutional. It would just mean that there's a question about whether the president can fire a director or not. And so I think it's the same here. You know, if the president ever actually tried to fire the director, then that would be the right time for the court, if it was being sincere and just trying to follow the law, that would be the right time for the court to decide whether the president has the constitutional power to fire a director. But the president hasn't done that. Nobody's talking about firing a director. I think it's even in the government's briefs in this case that the actual director of the CFPB, just like James Comey when he was directing the FBI, accepts that the president has the power to fire and wouldn't litigate that. And so there's no dispute here that everybody accepts that the president could fire the director if push came to shove, that the director would step aside if the president fired her. You know, so that's a real non-issue in reality. But yet I do believe that just simply because the CFPB, you know, was created by Elizabeth Warren, it's out there to protect consumers against banks and credit cards, and the Supreme Court is weaponizing their power against perceived liberal government programs, I think it's highly likely they're gonna rule that the CFPB is unconstitutional. I don't think any lower court would ever rule that way, and in this case, none did.
Now, the other thing I wanted to kind of ask about here is that we know that Justice Kavanaugh, we kind of know his opinion on this one, because he's already ruled against the CFPB before in the D.C. Circuit. So do you think the fact they're taking this up, I mean, in other words, I guess what I'm asking is do you think this might be one authored by Kavanaugh? In other words, do you think he might be the one pushing this forward? I know possible. We need four votes to bring it, you know, before the court, which we've obviously had, but
Yeah, I think they got four votes to bring, and I think they got five votes to destroy the CFPB. Again, I think purely for political reasons and not for legal reasons. But in terms of who's going to write the opinion, you know, I think Chief Justice Roberts will be in the majority. As long as he's in the majority, he gets to decide who writes the opinion. Right. I don't really have any insight into whether he would assign it to Kavanaugh or to someone else. But yeah, maybe Kavanaugh. I mean, I think someone like Thomas or Gorsuch would also want to write this opinion. So I don't have a prediction about who's going to write it.
What is kind of on a larger level that interests me as a presidential scholar about this case is how this perceived presidential power, and we could have an argument about whether, you know, the nature of presidential supremacy in the executive branch, and how that plays out, but how that is actually being used actually as a tool to alter the the executive branch agency's constitutionality itself. It's a weird circumstance to find oneself in when you think about it politically. Yeah. I mean, I understand what's happening, but the fact that the president has this potential power is what therefore makes the ability. I guess what you're really arguing is that that Congress is overstepping its bounds.
No, I don't think Congress overstepped its bounds. I think the court is going to overstep its bounds.
Oh, no, I agree. What I'm saying is that to get into that argument, what you have to be arguing effectively is that the court has to in some way be arguing that Congress is encroaching on the power of the presidency. Am I wrong about it?
Yeah, that's an old argument, too. I mean, actually, I thought you were going to mention when you gave the early history, that's precisely what Andrew Johnson was impeached for.
Yes.
Right. So Andrew Johnson was impeached.
Please do it. Yeah.
For firing the Secretary of War, what we would now call the Secretary of Defense. Congress at that time had passed a statute called the Tenure of Office Act that said that for those top cabinet positions, if the Senate was involved in confirming someone into the office, then the president couldn't fire unless the Senate consented to the firing. Now, Andrew Johnson fired Stanton, the Secretary of War, Lincoln's Secretary of War, and the firing was effective. He was able to fire him despite the existence of that statute. So Stanton was fired, but Congress impeached because of that. That was the failure to follow the law. That was the high crime that Andrew Johnson was impeached for, was that he fired Stanton in violation of the Tenure of Office Act. And he hung on, but you know, the almost two-thirds majority of the Senate voted to remove him, but they fell one vote short, so he wasn't removed. But certainly there was a very significant majority in the Senate that thought that the Congress could regulate that. Now, after that, in the 1920s and 30s, you had mentioned the Humphreys case, and there was a companion case called the Myers case. So in the 20s and 30s, there were two different times this came up. In Myers, President Taft had fired a postmaster, and the postmaster had civil service protections, and Taft fired him anyhow. And in that case, the court ruled that the president had unilateral authority to remove any executive branch officer, and that a statute could not say to the contrary. So the firing was effective. And in that sense, I guess the Myers court vindicated President Andrew Johnson's position from the impeachment trial. But then Humphreys comes down a few years later, and the Federal Trade Commission has similar civil service protections under their statute. And in Humphreys, the court says, well, it's different if it's an independent regulatory agency. An independent regulatory agency isn't really part of the executive branch at all, so the president doesn't have to have this authority to fire them. He only has to have authority to fire people in the executive branch. So that distinction persisted in the law from the 30s till the 80s. But actually, the Morrison v. Olson case that I mentioned earlier about the independent counsel under the Ethics in Government Act in the 80s, that completely overruled that distinction. That said that the Humphreys court was incorrect in thinking that the Federal Trade Commission was somehow outside the executive branch, and that actually any agency that can execute laws must necessarily be in the executive branch. So the old distinction from Myers and Humphreys, which is the one that I think the litigant in Seal of Law is trying to revive,
yes,
is the idea that there's some executive agencies and there's some independent agencies. And we can mainly tell the difference in this by looking at the executive agencies are headed up by a single head. The independent agencies are headed up by a multi-member commission. That's an old distinction that distinguished Myers from Humphreys in the 20s and 30s. But that distinction was utterly rejected in Morrison v. Olson, where the independent counsel was a single head of an independent counsel office who, in fact, could exercise the purely executive powers of the Justice Department. And the court said that, you know, this old distinction between executive agencies and independent agencies makes no sense. Any agency that can enforce a law is executive, but the president has the responsibility to take care that the laws are faithfully executed, but that doesn't mean that he has the power to fire people because they are faithfully executing the laws. It might mean that he has the power to fire people who aren't faithfully executing the laws, but a good cause requirement is consistent with that. So Congress can impose a good cause requirement. And that's what Morrison versus Olson holds. And it completely obliterates the old distinction between Humphreys and Myers. So I think the government's attempt to rely on that distinction already has no basis in contemporary law since the 1980s. But nonetheless, I don't doubt that the Supreme Court will revive all that. I think they came into this thinking they're gonna take a guillotine to the CFPB and they'll get there however they need to. And that's really all that we're looking at here.
I always find those things. I don't know. I've always loved the legal side, even though that's not my particular expertise. So, as a matter of fact, for our next story, Ken, we're going to stay in your wheelhouse. We're going to stay inside the court, and we're going to take a look at Patterson v. Walgreens. Now, this case is a little bit different because this week the Supreme Court actually denied certiorari denied cert to Patterson, allowing the lower court ruling to hold. But it's a really big and important one. And as a matter of fact, it happened near my home reform town of Daytona Beach. It was in Orlando, Florida. Daryl Patterson, is an African-American man who was potentially forced to choose between his Seventh-day Adventist faith and his employment with Walgreens. Now, what happened was that in 2005, Patterson was interviewed for a position at a Walgreens call center in Orlando. And during the interview process, he made it clear, according to his filings, that because he was a Seventh-day Adventist, he could not work from sunset on Friday to sunset on Saturday. He went ahead and was hired without question, and he worked without issue until 2011. Then in 2011, unrelatedly, Walgreens broke a law in Alabama, and as a result, they were going to have to do these two-hour training sessions. Patterson was scheduled for a Saturday. He tried to change it. Because of the time-sensitive nature of it, that wasn't possible. Patterson instead did his work that should have been performed on Saturday on Monday, and he was consequently fired nearly immediately for not showing up to work on Saturday. And so the issue at hand was the Civil Rights Act of 1964's Title VII, which prohibits employment discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. Further, they have to, quote, reasonably accommodate workers' religious practices unless that would cause the company, quote, undue hardship, end quote. Walgreens argued that the Title VII requires that only employers do that reasonable accommodation, and they don't have to totally accommodate. Patterson sued in 2014. Walgreens' position was upheld. It was upheld again at the appellate level, and then here just on the 24th, the Supreme Court, like I said, denied certiorari and allowed the lower court decision to stand. I was a little bit surprised that the Supreme Court had turned it down. And I there's a lot of things to talk here about, Kim, but I wanted to start with, why do you think the Supreme Court turned this one down? It seemed like one that kind of often would fit the bill for them.
Yeah, I think one thing that sometimes happens at the court is that if the five conservative justices are not sure how all five of their brethren would vote, they sometimes don't want to take a case for fear that it might not come out the way they want it to. And here, you know, this one does pit, big business against religious freedom. And I think conservative justices they like both sides, you know, they like big business and they like religious freedom, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that, And I think that many of them might just thought, well, this is a little bit of a roll of the dice. You know, I think in cases where rights of religious freedom are pitted against, say, governments, you know, I think the conservatives are more sure lately that they can hold a block together and give a victory to religious freedom rights. You know, I think here there may have been some uncertainty on the part of individual justices about which way they even thought the case should come out, and some uncertainty on the part of individual justices about how the other justices would think the case should come out. So I think that kind of thing might have just figured into, you know, the idea that I think a lot of the conservative justices who are trying to advance a religious rights agenda may not have seen this as the best vehicle to do it, and there'd be plenty of other cases.
Now here's the other one. This is probably harder, and I recognize that, especially since we don't have unlimited amounts of time. But how would you have, if you were on the court and the court was taking this up, how would you have ruled, Ken?
For me, that's a doubly hard question. Tell you why. It's because I don't really believe, I would not favor these reasonable accommodation provisions myself, but they are part of the law. Yeah. So you'd have to ask, you know, A, what if I could shape the law, how would I shape the law? But then you'd have to ask B, given the law that we have, how would I interpret it? Given the law that we have, I think the plaintiff should have won. And I think that's probably what you think also, that I think Walgreens could reasonably have accommodated this plaintiff. And so a law that requires reasonable accommodation, I think, should have required this accommodation. I don't believe it put any undue hardship on Walgreens to accommodate. It's a very large employer with a very large number of employees. And if they have to shift schedules around a little bit, I cannot see how that's so tough on them. On the other hand, I don't really love religious exemptions from neutral laws of general applicability. You know, I think I don't mind them in cases like this where they tend to help members of religious minorities. But I think the reason I don't like them generally is because they're often used by religious majorities. And I really don't I don't think that the Hobby Lobby type of that line of cases is good at all. You know, I don't like to see religious exemptions being used to give people a right to illegally discriminate and things like that. And I think that's just what you get when you have these religious accommodations. So if it was up to me to make the law, I'd get rid of the whole thing. But if it was up to me to interpret the law, I would say the plaintiff had the stronger argument.
Now, if you were getting rid of the law, though, don't you think that if you threw out Title VII,
I wouldn't throw out Title VII. I'd only throw out the reasonable accommodation requirement.
Okay. So but don't you think that even just the employment discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, or national origin might in and of itself include what happened in the Patterson case?
No, I don't look at it that way. So to me, there's a big difference between, you know, if a Jehovah's Witness wants to get hired and the employer says, I won't hire you because you're a Jehovah's Witness, that's discrimination that I think should be illegal. But if the Jehovah's Witness says, you know, I want to be hired, and because I'm a Jehovah's Witness, I want to have different terms and conditions of employment than all the other employees have, I want that reasonable accommodation. Well, that's what the law holds, but I don't like that law. I think the law should say that people should be treated the same without regard to their race, religion, sex, anything like that. But I would not say that people should have a right to get special rights because of their race, religion, sex, or anything like that. So I absolutely approve of the prohibition against employment discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, and national origin. But my understanding of what it means to discriminate is to treat people differently. And I think giving people special rights that the other employees don't have is not consistent with that. So I don't really favor it.
So to then bring into this, I hadn't thought about this in advance. So what would be your position on, for instance, the famous peyote cases? I know that's not in that case employment. Yeah. In that case, we're talking about a government service an exemption on the basis of religion. In some ways, these two cases would be in agreement with one another on that front. So what about on that side?
Yeah. Right. So for the listeners, you're talking about a case called Employment Division versus Smith, which the Supreme Court decided back in 1990. And it actually did peripherally involve employment, because what happened there was there were these two Native American Indians who were actually working as drug counselors. They were working with youth and helping counsel them how to get off of drugs. And it transpired that both of these guys, being Native American Indians, they participated in Native American religious ceremonies where they themselves smoked peyote. And when their employer found out about that, he fired them. And then when they tried to get on unemployment for having been fired, the unemployment agency said, well, you were fired for cause because you took drugs, and so you're not eligible to go on unemployment. And that's what brought the case up to the Supreme Court. So the government program was unemployment insurance, but it did trigger from the fact that firing. They were fired.
In this case, they weren't suing the, unlike here in Patterson, where Patterson's suing the company, they were suing the unemployment office.
Yeah, they were suing the unemployment office. So they end up suing the government, but it all stems from being fired because they weren't given a special right to use peyote. And the Supreme Court says in that case, and this is a very much criticized holding, but the Supreme Court says they didn't have any right to smoke peyote and work as drug counselors, that if all the other drug counselors are not allowed to smoke peyote, then they're also not allowed to smoke peyote, even though their religion requires it. Now, at the time, I thought that was a wrong holding. At the time, I probably would have agreed with Congress, which tried to overrule it with a statute called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
That's why I brought it up, because I was wondering what your feelings on that were.
But I'm saying, really, my feelings changed over the 20 years of experience. So today, I would think that the Smith holding was correct, and it took me a while to get there. But the reason I think the Smith holding was correct, and that you know, even though I'm really all in favor as a policy matter of allowing members of small religious minorities to get exemptions from neutral laws of general applicability, but I think what's inevitable if you allow that is that you end up also having to allow members of religious majorities to get those same exemptions. And then that leads ultimately, I think, to this line of cases that I think causes great harm to our society. The cases like Hobby Lobby, where, you have stores saying, well, we won't provide contraceptive coverage in the health insurance for our employees, even though the law requires us to, because it's against our religion. Or you have cases like the Masterpiece Cake Shop, where the baker, who's really required to sell money to sell a cake to anyone who walks in and pays money for it under law, will say, well, I've got a religious right to discriminate against same-sex wedded couples. I think that all gets into a bad area where every person can kind of be a law unto themselves and decide, I don't want to follow the law, so I'll just say it's against my religion to follow the law and have a presumptive right to do that. I think it ends up causing too many problems. So I think Smith has a lot of appeal on the facts. And just like probably you and most people, you know, I was more sympathetic to those Indians in Smith than to that unemployment office. But I think if you really try to apply that concept too broadly, it's not worth it. I think I'd get rid of it.
That is that's not the way that I thought that you would argue to be wrong. That's why I pushed into those cases. I had not planned on doing that because that's not generally the way that I would.
I like to think of myself as a civil libertarian, and I think
that's the word I'm thinking of. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's right. I mean, this is kind of it's an exception to my general civil libertarianism, but it's because I really think the concept it's too expansive. I think if it could be limited to the cases, both including the Smith case itself and including this case we're talking about today with Walgreens, where you have members of small religious minorities wanting exemptions from laws where the law probably didn't even think about the existence of those religions when the law was enacted. So the law is not there to try to oppress anyone's religion, but it has the incidental effect sometimes of violating people's religion. I don't have a problem really with those people getting exemptions, but my problem is that I don't know how you can give them exemptions without giving everyone else exemptions. And if you start giving everyone else exemptions, I think it really becomes too much of a system where people can pick and choose what laws they want to comply with and where a lot of very important objectives of law can't be fulfilled. So in the modern context, I think the number one kind of claim you hear today for religious exemptions is people who want religious exemptions so that they can discriminate against gay people or so that they can, so they can interfere with women's right to contraception or to abortion or something like that. And I think, you know, that's where most of the action is under these religious exemption claims today. And I'm not as sympathetic to that.
You know, really, to be honest, what I thought that we would spend the bulk of our time discussing was the different, you know, the kind of vagueness of a reasonable accommodation, because that's where I myself find I have some of the trouble is, I guess, unlike you, I'm on board with having religious accommodations, but I struggle with, well, what does it mean for it to be reasonable? Like, what does that look like, right? I mean, showing up for work versus something, you know, or in this instance, what kind of struck me was, you know, you have a singular instance of somebody not showing up for work is the thing that triggers the firing. So is it the severity of the response to that or not? So I, you know, for me, I was centering on the, how ought one to interpret what I see as being that, that kind of vague phrase, and so that, so it's your take is not what I had expected on that front, Ken, but that's not what I would have thought, but it's a worthwhile argument that I'd have to consider a little bit more. And I'll be honest, I had it in advance. But I will say, I think that we've actually gone a little, I'm so sorry. Finish your thought.
I was going to say unreasonable accommodation. You know, there are a lot of cases, not only in the religious discrimination context, but also under statutes like the Americans with Disabilities Act, because disabled people are entitled to reasonable accommodations. Also, there's enough cases out there that I think even though it's it can be hard to come up with a definition of how do we draw the line between reasonable accommodation and undue hardship. Usually, when they litigate these things, you can find a precedent on point where that you know, in this particular context, that's already been done. And I'd have to say, given the way the law is, I think this that it would not be that hard for Walgreens to accommodate an employee who doesn't want to come in on a Saturday. The employees only come in 5 days a week. They have 2 days off, and other employees could come in on a Saturday. And I just don't see what would be so hard to accommodate this one.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, in this specific instance, I'm not sure. And it's, again, you'd like to know more about the, you know, why one instance? I mean, even if I didn't show up one day to teach, I don't think that'd end up getting me fired.
But
well, be that as it may, I think we better close the show for today there. Thank you for listening to The Politics Guys. All of the hosts, myself included, we truly love working on the show. It's a labor of love. And to make it possible, it takes the support of amazing listeners like you. One of the ways that you can help the show is by subscribing to The Politics Guys on the podcast app of your choice. So does sharing episodes. Word of mouth advertising is the best, and we certainly appreciate it. We also need your support. One of the many great things about being a supporter is you get access to supporters-only content, including our full-length supporters-only Wednesday show. Ken and I will be on again on Wednesday for supporters. If you want to become a supporter, check out one or more of the benefits that we have of supporting The Politics Guys. Head to our Patreon page, patreon.com/politicsguys. Or you can go to politicsguys.com/support. For access to that Wednesday episode requires just a $5 monthly donation. But of course, you, if that's a hardship, you can always reach us at mail@politicsguys.com. We don't want to leave you out. Please join me and Ken again on Wednesday by heading to patreon.com/politicsguys. If you have questions, comments, corrections, or just some other random thought you want to share, you can reach us at mail@politicsguys.com. We also strive for civil and rational debate on our Reddit at Bipartisan Politics. We're also on Twitter at Politics Guys. The executive producers of The Politics Guys are Bruce Johnson, Wilmer Murano, Andra Masker, Daniel Toe, and Chris Wilkerson. Today's show was produced by Trey Orndorff. We'll be back with a new show on Wednesday. We hope you'll join us then.